This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am in a remote location. I'm getting more and more remote every day. This time I am actually in my kitchen, because it's the quietest house in the room, which is very strange because I am running the dishwasher. So this is also, listen to me, Whirlpool, if you are out there, if anyone knows Whirlpool, they should absolutely sponsor Joy on Paper, because I am sitting in the kitchen. I forgot that what time the program came on. I turned on the dishwasher, and it is so quiet. The Whirlpool is so quiet. I love it. I don't hear it. It's amazing, and I put it on full blast wash cycle, and it's so quiet. I am so happy because I had a Samsung before that was so noisy. It was like a tank was always in the house. So it is just a thrill to be here in my kitchen. And because I'm having computer problems. And my son, who is in Madison, Wisconsin, is trying to help me on remote, and he keeps giving me instructions, and I climbed underneath the computer, and I changed wires and all sorts of stuff. And anyway, it's still a mess. So I don't have any, I could not hook up my Skype microphones, and I actually don't have any sound on my computer at the moment. So I have sent Ed two files from two of my favorite authors that have been on the program. One is Paco Chierici. I just love this guy. He is just a wonderful guy. Of course, he is a pilot, and I don't have a long time to talk about him now because he's going to be in the tape, and I hope you will listen to that one. And then after that, I have Philip Vega, who is from Tampa, and he came into the studio, and I admire this author so much. I do think, actually, both of his books should be turned into films, as Paco's should. So I will let the tapes speak for themselves. Anyway, we will Ed will control everything from there, and hopefully at the end I will have a little time to come back and say thank you to everyone who has been sending me wonderful messages. But meanwhile, here is, we'll start with a tape of, I had this wonderful interview with Paco. He is just a delightful guy. So here goes. Ed, play that one and then continue on, okay?
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with the elite of the elite, the top of the top, a real top gun. This is so exciting for me because, as all of you know, I love pilots. I go giddy around pilots, and particularly I think I would go giddy around this pilot. It is so absolutely fantastic for me to welcome to the program Paco. Now, I'm going to ask you, Paco, how you want your name pronounced, because I'm sure people have messed it up over and over.
Yeah, forever. It's pronounced just the way it's spelled, Chierici.
Well, I knew it was Chierici, but because most people don't know that in Italian, CH is pronounced K, I'm sure you've had it pronounced many, many ways.
Exactly, yeah. I just say it's like Chianti.
That's the way to do it. And I'm sure all the women out there would just love to sit down and have Chianti with you. Paco, I must say, as I said, I get a little giddy around pilots. I have been that way ever since I met my husband. Well, no, actually, I've always loved, even as a girl, if in those days, if they would have had women fighter pilots, I would have joined the Air Force. But, of course, you are amazing. And when I say the top gun of the top guns, I mean, I was reading about the fact that you have 3,000 tactical hours and 400 carrier landings. Wow.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I have a number of friends that have many more hours of carrier landings than I do.
Well, don't be modest. I don't think any F-18 Hornet pilots are modest. You guys are all so, and gals now, are so amazing, which is why we're one of the elements in this book that we have gals. This book is the first of what I'm sure are going to be many books by you, the first novel. It's called Lions of the Sky, and it is terrific.
Thank you.
Well, you know, you've been... I don't know who your favorite authors were, say sort of a mix of Clancy, and I can't think of all of the wonderful ones that you've learned by some magic that your first novel is so great.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Well, where do we start with this book? It's so funny. One of the things it starts off with a road race, which it's one of the best road races that anybody's written in a book, because I felt like I was in that race with, and I'm wishing I was in that race with you. It was fantastic.
Well, that's great. Yeah, it's a fun theme. I really enjoyed writing, and I'm glad you enjoyed reading it.
Oh yeah. Now tell me, do you own a Shelby Cobra?
Own a sports car. Uh-huh. I do. Aside from flying fighter planes and jets, I do also love. You know, driving a sports car, and I take my car out on the track. My main character, Slammer Richardson, has a 1966 Shelby Cobra, which in the real world is worth millions of dollars. So no,
you don't have it. I was wondering. Oh well, you know, the thing is, once they make this book into a film, you'll have millions of dollars, and then you can buy a Shelby Cobra.
There we go.
It is a beautiful car. It is one of the most.
This is my dream car. I love those cars.
Oh, it's such a gorgeous car. So we start off with Slammer, and that of course is a great name. It's a great name.
Yeah.
And tell us about this character that you've developed.
Well, he's great. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to do with this first novel in the series is sort of set the stage, obviously, for the world that these people live in, and also show that things have come a long way, especially, you know, in my experience from when I started off flying in the military to where things are now. You know, there was a lot of resistance to women being in the cockpit for combat. And Slammer is a really good guy with a pretty deep flaw, right? I mean, we all love our main characters to have a really a deep flaw, but a good character inside. And his flaw is that he mistrusts women in the cockpit. And so I wanted to give him an opportunity to change, to learn and change, and to start off in one place and end up in another. And then his foil, Keely Silvers, is the instrument of that change, right? She's going to be the one that challenges his perception and forces him to look deep inside himself and ultimately to, you know, to come to believe what he believes in the end. I don't want to give it away too much, but, you know, she is that catalyst of introspection for him.
Well, you know, when you wrote this book, of course, it's based on all of the wonderful people that you worked with, and I'm sure some of them are really thrilled to see themselves in this book. Tell us about this. You know, as fighter pilots, you are such an elite group of people. And of course, the F-18 Super Hornet is such an amazing plane. Tell us about what it's like to fly this Super Hornet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes an entire book to really describe it. But it is the most thrilling thing that I could possibly imagine doing. You know, we take off from an aircraft carrier, which is, you know, at the same time, it's the largest, one of the largest ships in the world, but it is by far the smallest airport in the world. And of course, it happens to be floating in the middle of the ocean. But you take off from an aircraft carrier and you weigh roughly 65,000 pounds, and you get slung from the ship in about 250 feet, 300 feet from 0 to 170 miles an hour. And that's just the beginning of your day. That's, you know, like waking up and going off to work. So you go off and you fly your missions. Obviously, most of the stuff that we do is training. You know, while you're up there, you're going the speed of sound. You're if you're practicing dogfighting, you're going at another airplane at 1,000 miles an hour of closure and passing by him by 200 feet before pulling 7 G's to try and get behind him and get a shot off. So there's incredible speed and dynamic motion and forces of gravity on the body. So it's really like an intense workout. And then when it's time to, you know, come back to the ship, you come in for the overhead brake, which is a maneuver that we use to get back onto the ship, where you're going about 600 miles an hour or 800 feet, and you fly over the ship and pull 6 G's to slow yourself down. And as you slow down, you drop your gear and flaps and keep your turn coming and descend to 600 feet. And then with about 90 degrees to go to line up to the ship, you're about 450 feet and everything's all out. Your gear, hook, and flaps are all positioned. You're now on speed and you roll behind the ship into the groove, it's called. And you've got 15 seconds to line yourself up just perfectly and get that hook between the 2 and the 3 wire and snag a wire. And again, you're going from about 160, 150 miles an hour to zero in 150 feet. And when you hit the deck, you hit so hard that your head snaps forward and your left hand reflexively goes to full power, just in case you miss all the wires and your hook skips, and then you can bounce back up in the air again and try it again. So it's from, you know, from the word go, it's just a dynamic, exciting, sweaty, intense adrenaline adventure. And it's wonderful. And from beginning to end, it's just a really great way to live life.
I wanted you to explain it like that. I knew you would, because just for the listener listening to that, I think everyone was holding their breath until you landed, you know, and you create that in the book. It is quite amazing. All of your scenes, you know, you have these scenes where the pilots are taking off, where the pilots are landing, or other things are happening. But we feel, as a reader, that we are right there with you. And this is such a wonderful talent. You draw us in so beautifully.
Oh, thanks. Well, I mean, that's my primary goal, is to write a thriller where the reader feels like they're with me, right? So I didn't want to overwhelm people with hardcore technical data or, you know, make them feel like they're observers of the action. I really, really wanted the reader to be part of the action and to feel like they're in the cockpit and in the squadron, in the ready room, involved in the banter and, you know, the parties and just to immerse themselves in the experience.
Well, you succeeded. And on top of it, you brought in an international theme with a, you know, real danger, a real thriller in sort of the Tom Clancy mode. It's just the whole story just comes together so nicely. And of course, the characters, you really make us care about these characters and worry about them. And sometimes breaks our heart, you know, when you're in a dangerous business.
Yeah, for sure.
I want to tell people that if they're really looking for a thrilling read, and I'm sure, you know, they're going to make a film of it. And luckily, of course, we have Super Hornets that are flying. So when they make the film, it will be easy, because I have been deeply involved for a number of years in a project called the Forgotten F-105 Warriors. I've been trying to make this film about the Thud Pilots. But we don't have one flying F-105, not one.
So make it more difficult.
They just destroy these planes. So I don't know. You also flew the A-6s.
I don't think there's any A-6s flying, no. I mean, there's, you know, Davis Mothman is the boneyard in the desert where they preserve old fighter planes. So, you know, I'll bet you there's a bunch of thuds up in the desert.
No, there aren't a bunch of thuds. Right. They just went in and destroyed them all. They didn't even offer them to museums, and a lot of museums would have wanted them. They just destroyed them. I don't understand it. I can't imagine the day when they're going to destroy the last Super Hornet. How much does a Super Hornet cost?
About $60 million-ish.
$60 million, give or take.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how many we have today flying. We have
a few hundred.
Okay, you know, I don't know what's... what about the F-14? That's the one from Top Gun, the movie.
There are no F-14s flying except for in Iran, which is the plot or part of the plot of my next book.
Aha. Well, I hope that in your next book, I lived and worked in Iran for quite a few years, as a matter of fact, and I actually taught at the Air Force base there. I taught English. So I hope in your book that you capture a few of them and bring them back.
Well, one of my characters, much like the Chinese commando character in the first book, one of my characters is an Iranian F-14 14 pilots. So I'll need to lean on you for a little bit of experience.
Ah, okay. Wow, that's exciting. This is, I think I was like into page, maybe about page 14, and I said, okay, I know this is going to be a film. And then as I'm reading, and as you are introducing the characters, and I realize so many of the characters have a lot of life left in them, although I knew some of them were going to die. somebody has to die, and I wasn't sure who, but I kept saying, okay, well, he's building not characters just for this book. These are characters we will want to see again and again. By the end of the book, I knew, oh, okay, this is a series. This isn't one book, because I'm sure you have a million stories that you've stored away.
I do. I have about 20 good books in me.
That's exciting. So I have to go back to this racing of the cars.
Sure.
Are the cops in Virginia Beach so good that they never give anybody speeding tickets? Because you pilots do drive fast. I know that.
We do. I'm not as young as I used to be, but when I was a new fighter pilot and living in Virginia Beach, I don't live in Virginia Beach now, but when I did, obviously, back then, I had a few speeding tickets. And I used to drive those back roads, when I needed to go out and clear my head. So it's not quite a recreation. It didn't exactly happen that way, but I'm very familiar with driving fast on those lonely back roads and the Virginia and North Carolina border.
Around here in Florida, the police get their Christmas bonus by giving people speeding tickets for going like 45 miles an hour during this little chase. I'm holding my breath until we get to the end of it. And then it hit me. Boy, that would be one heck of a speeding ticket here.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that wouldn't be fun in a story.
Yeah, it would. You're still an active pilot.
I am, but not with the military.
I'm
retired out of the military now, yeah, fortunately. But yes, I fly a commercial airline pilot, 737 captain.
As I said, because I have been deeply involved with this F-105 project, I know you guys are a special breed. Really, you have to be to take on this challenge of risking your life. It looks very nice to see the planes up there, but every time you're up there, you are risking your life, and it is such a dangerous thing. But I don't think you guys actually think of it in that term, do you?
No, you can't. I mean, it's the danger, as you mentioned, is ever present, and it the way we operate is so close to the edge of safety, and we have to, because that's, when you're in combat, you can't, drive in the middle of the road. You have to take chances, and inevitably things happen, either whether it's a mechanical malfunction that causes an accident or pilot error. Which causes a crash. Things happen and people die. In the back of the book, I've got a section.
A list. It's heartbreaking. I've actually read it a few times because you have also their call signs in there. One of my very first guests on Joy on Paper when I started it just over 4 years ago was Colonel Leo Thorsness, who received the Medal of Honor for a flight that he did in Vietnam in the F-105. 11 days after the flight that he received the Medal of Honor for, he was captured. He spent over 1,000 days in captivity. I talked to him quite a few times. He said he was never afraid when he was in an airplane because it was such a joy to be in the airplane and going fast.
Right. I mean, you don't internalize the risk, because then you wouldn't be able to do your job. And even after, I've been to a number of memorial services where you pay homage to the people that have passed away, and there's a missing man formation, and it's very emotional. And then, later that day, or maybe early the next morning, you're back in the saddle, you're flying, and out of all the people that I knew that crashed and died, there was only one that really, it was a friend of mine and my wife's who were very, very close, and he passed away on our honeymoon. He had been in our wedding, and it affected me for months. I would think of him as I was flying, and it was difficult. Eventually you have to take that and put it in a little box and put it in the back of your head so that it doesn't affect your work. It wears on you, and, after doing it for 20 years, once you're done, you come to the realization that you feel very fortunate you survived. There's so many people that didn't make it, so many families without fathers and in one case a mother, that you feel grateful that you made it. And it's kind of a bizarre sensation that you finally come to grips with all that loss.
I think you are an amazing American hero for all of the missions that you flew for us. sometimes I just close my eyes and I try to imagine how you must feel when you're in the plane coming fast toward this little spot in the ocean. It's really mind-boggling. Humans are capable of so much wonder. Really, it's so amazing the things that we can do and can create, that we created a plane that can land on a little thing in the middle of the ocean. And you just wish sometimes we were up to the standards of this wonderful, wonderful capability, that we should all be so proud of, all of us who just put our hearts into doing something special. And you are particularly amazing to me.
Well, thank you. I'm certainly no hero. I just, was a young kid who got a thrill out of flying airplanes and was fortunate enough to be able to do it for 20 years.
The new book is called Lions of the Sky, and your website is Lions of the Sky, right? Lionsofthesky.com.
That's correct.
People can go there. The name is Paco Chiarici.
Chiarici, correct. Very good.
Okay. Think of Chianti. It'd be wonderful to sit down with you over a bottle of Chianti and talk about all of your exciting, exciting adventures. It's a wonderful book. It's a love story. It's a thriller. It's an international thriller. And it's very timely because it involves China. And we're all thinking a lot about China. So there's so many reasons to read this book. And the best is, it's just a real exciting ride.
Thank you so much.
Are you working on the new book? And as soon as it comes out, I want you to come back and join me here on Joy on Paper, because it's been a real joy to talk to you today, Paco.
Thank you, Patsy. I really appreciate it. I will definitely do that.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow. He's amazing. Can you imagine landing on an aircraft carrier? The book is so good, and it's called Lions of the Sky. And he's an amazing writer. If you like Tom Clancy or any thriller writer, he's right up there. And he's, I'm sure, going to have a long, long career now as a writer. And I predict, definitely, Lions of the Sky is going to be a major motion picture, because it's really, really an exciting book. Bye-bye now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, it's so good to have you. You are an amazing writer.
Thank you.
Because, as I said, when a first page grabs you and you can't stop reading it, it is such an exciting moment. And I will tell everyone, the first page starts here in a supermarket. And, woo, You will never walk down a supermarket aisle again, I think, without thinking about Phil's book. I mean, now I'm walking down the aisle of the supermarket. I'm thinking, oh, now who's over there? Who's there? You know, all the stories that you could just make up with just that idea of seeing somebody in a supermarket.
Well, you know, my wife and I, you know, we do go food shopping together, and the genesis or the next of this. Of this book actually did, to be quite frank, did start in a supermarket. But I love people watching, and then I'm one of those individuals who, you know, doesn't mind shopping and, you know, just people watching.
All of you out there who are thinking about writing, Phil is an example here of somebody who didn't think there was a book in him. And as I've told all of you, there is at least one book in you. Now, it might be memoir, but it might be a fantastic novel like Phil has written, because if you just sort of step back and say, well, I know something about one of my relatives, I remember this interesting story, you might just actually have a book in you. But Phil, you're telling me, you know, it's hard to believe when I've read this book, because it is so very good.
Thank you.
That you didn't always think that you were going to be a writer.
That's true. So it was being a writer, producing, you know, a novel, you know, coming up with a manuscript. It was never on the roadmap, never in my wildest dreams. It wasn't part of my bucket list. It wasn't part of anything. So it really just happened. Frankly, one rainy Saturday afternoon after coming home from food shopping with my wife, she went in to take a nap, and it was, you know, one of those rainy August Saturdays here in lovely Tampa Bay, Florida area. And I sat down to watch TV. There was nothing on TV. You know, there wasn't any golf. There was nothing of interest. So I sat there, and this idea, you know, just kind of produced in the back of my mind's eye. And you know, my process might be a little different than others, but you know, this story just kind of appeared in my mind's eye and started playing out as almost a video or a movie. And so something inside me said, you know, you start writing this down. And so I grabbed my iPad and I just started, you know, just kind of typing away. And before I knew it, I had three chapters written on my iPad. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I knew that I needed to get this story that was developing in my mind out of me. It needed to go from my thoughts and my imagination out onto now paper. And it took me from the beginning of August, took me 6 weeks to complete. It was about just under 800 pages, so there was a lot of editing done with my I went on a lot of tangents. So working with my editor, now publisher, Janet Fix, with the word Verve, you know, we did a bit of editing and we, you know, came up with you know, Last Exit to Montauk.
Well, it is, as I said, it is so nice to find somebody who has actually done it from that moment that you see it in your head, and then you just don't stop thinking about it and get it down on paper. The title is The Last Exit from Montauk. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the story? Don't give away any of the good stuff, but tell because it is exciting. You're not sure what's going to happen, and that's part of the fun of reading this book. For people who don't know where Montauk is, for goodness sakes.
Sure.
What? Tell us about
sure.
it.
Sure. Well, first, let me just take a step back. I want to wish a happy belated birthday to your sister Natalie.
Oh,
because she's a February baby, just like I am. It's my birthday tomorrow, and also to my 92-year-old aunt, whose birthday it is today. So, I want to wish them a happy birthday. So, I want to get that out of the way. So Last Exit to Montauk. It's set on Long Island. So Montauk is on the end of Long Island. The story's not set in Montauk. It's actually set in a town called Stony Brook, which is in Suffolk County, on the north shore of Suffolk County, in and around what's called the Three Village area, which is Stony Brook, Setauket area. And it's set in the mid-80s. It's a coming-of-age love story, interracial love story between two people in their senior year. It's set over the end of the summer, over a 3-week period. And the story is a little different in that as I developed the story, one of the things that came to mind, it has some strong female characters and strong Latin characters. One of the things that I just don't see out in the media. I don't see it in publication. Are characters of Latin background that are not blue collar. So the characters in this story, the main character's mother, she's a pediatric surgeon, and she's a well respected member of the community. You know, they're not migrant workers. They live in a upper middle class area on Long Island. You know, she's providing for her family. One of the older brother in the story, graduated from Dartmouth, and has moved up to Boston to start his career. So these are well respected, white collar Latinos that I just don't see out in the media.
You're right. That's true, and I think that's what makes this a particularly compelling story, is that you've described this family so well, and thanks, we get to really know them. How can I say, I'm so tired, tell you the truth, I'm so tired of the race thing, because there's nothing shocking about this relationship. It's just a beautiful relationship, and that's what we have to see. I don't see color. I mean, I know there's this element of it,
sure,
but when you're it doesn't matter if the characters were black. I mean, it's all the same. It's just human beings finding each other.
And that was my goal. And it was my goal of I grew up, actually my mother was a physician, so I can you write what you know. One of the questions I often get asked is, what's your writing process? What do you recommend to others? And I often recommend, write what you know. Write what you know. I grew up in this kind of environment, in this township, actually. So many of the places, many of the locales are real. I reference the Smith Haven Mall. I reference Friendly's, which are staples in this township. So they're real locations. I mention things like the Hercules statue in Stony Brook. That's really there. Some of the beaches that I reference, those are there. Montauk Point, the lighthouse, that's what it's famous. One of the things it's famous for, there's a very famous lighthouse. So these locales, and my goal was making the relationship not about race, but about these two young kids falling in love, and it didn't matter that she was blonde and of a Scandinavian, Norwegian, Swedish background, and it didn't matter that he was of Hispanic background. It was just a happenstance meeting in a supermarket. These two young kids, him coming from playing tennis and running an errand for his mother, and he just happens, he's just came back from playing tennis with his best friend. He's tired, so he's tired and he's thirsty. He wants to stop at a supermarket to get something to drink, and he happens to see this girl who attends his same school, and it's a private school, who he knows, but he doesn't really know that well. He didn't realize she lived in the area, and they strike up a friendship, and the friendship quickly develops into a loveship.
It is a beautiful love story.
Thank you.
And I think, of course, one of the reasons, the characters are well drawn. You mentioned the blonde beauty.
Yes.
And who is known as B.
Yes.
I think she is one of the loveliest characters.
Well, thank you.
Because she's just, there's such a goodness about her, and the way that she acts and the way that she thinks. I found myself so drawn to her, and I think all the readers will, because it's just beautifully done.
Thank you. I tell you, as I wrote the story, and it's written in first person, so my goal is for the reader to, as they're reading it, have it become their story, as the readers are reading, And but as I wrote the story, it was again, you know, it developed out of a in my mind's eye, almost as, you know, watching a video or a movie, and I was just kind of there as the witness writing the story. And as I was writing it, I too found myself falling in love with this fictional character. I mean, I fell in love with her. You know, and I fell in love with the families, and I fell in love with all the characters. They just became real for me, which, you know, hopefully as people read them, and I've been truly blessed with the reviews and the feedback that I'm getting on Last Exit to Montauk. It seems to not only just capture everybody else's imagination, but it seems to be real for them as well.
That's right. You did get some great reviews. And when people read a book and they immediately get this feeling that they are with the narrator, and as I love first-person narration, because you really do feel that you are traveling this adventure with the character. So this was a deliberate choice to do it in the first person.
It was. And that is the narrative that I will be using for most of my novels at this point. You know, I've again, writing a novel wasn't on my roadmap. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't on the bucket list. Although I started and completed it right before I turned 50, right as I was 49. So, but since completing Last Exit to Montauk, the floodgates have opened for me, and I have right now, and my publisher, Janet Fix at the Word Verve, is very excited to know that I have, you know, 15 other manuscripts in development, you know, at different stages. And you know, I've recently submitted my second one. I'm working on my third now. My goal for 2018 is to complete two. So I want to finish my third one and my fourth one by the end of the year. But, you know, they just come to me. And I tell people, you know what, just sit down, you know, kind of tune everything out and just write.
All of your life experiences just come all together at the right time.
Yeah.
You hit it right here just before you're 50. And now you are like going like gangbusters, that you're going to be writing so many stories. Of course, the first person, as I said, I love the first person. It's funny that, you know, Lee Child and I were talking about, you know, he writes Jack Reacher, and he alternates every once in a while. He likes, you know, he does third person.
I love Lee Child. I love the
but
Jack Reacher.
But he does this alternate. Every once in a while, he has to write a first person because he just is so into the story.
Right.
That he just wants to tell it. I you know, so he was telling me he gets so excited about it that sometimes those ones really flow the fastest because he is telling the stories, you know, directly.
And I love Lee Child. I have a deep fondness for his work, and we were talking earlier about your library. Much of my library has Lee Child in it. So.
Well, you know, the funny thing, now he was 39 when he started writing, and of course that was a result of him getting fired. So and he was desperate. Luckily, you still have your day job.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
you can work, you can keep the day job till you can retire on a nice pension and don't have to worry about that kind of thing. But you know, he wrote Jack Reacher because he was fired and he was in a bad mood. And that's how it started.
And I wrote Last Exit to Montauk because, you know, there was nothing on TV. It was a rainy Saturday afternoon in Florida.
I mean, think about that. If there had been a great, you know, golf game.
If Tiger Woods were playing, if the Rays were playing, if something of interest on TV caught my attention, I would have put my iPad down and would have, you know,
aren't we lucky?
Watched TV.
Yes, that's... sometimes it's serendipity, you know, it's serendipity. things just come right. And so we are very happy.
Well, thanks.
And actually, you could probably start writing. There's nothing on television. I can't even turn it on anymore. I don't want to. I don't. I just can't. It's just there's too much. And so I hope a lot of you people are just turn off that television. And as I said, if you write a page a day in a year, you'll have 365 pages. And you have just about, that's I think, 366 pages.
Yep, thereabouts. Yeah,
So it's almost like, so, you know. Well, it sounds easy and it sounds difficult. A page day. Now, you did it in 6 weeks, right?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. That's almost like a little bit more than somebody does on a NaNoWriMo. So,
Right. Interestingly enough, I completed my second novel in that same amount of time.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you've seen the story in your head and you know where it's going and you know. You have that excitement that you can't stop writing. You just, isn't it difficult sometimes when you're writing and you have to actually stop for other things?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. Now my wife and I, my wife is my rock and my blessing, my wife Jeanette. And so she and I have been together for 27 years and married this year for 25. And she is truly my immortal beloved. And so there were many, many mornings when she would come into my office and I'd sit there and I was typing away and she'd look at me and she'd ask me, you didn't make it to bed last night, did you? And I'd look at her and go, oh, no, I came to bed. I just got up early. And she would just shake her head, just laugh at me, knowing, you know, I was lying to her and because I'd start writing at 10 o'clock at night, and I would, 8 o'clock in the morning, I was still,
still going.
Typing away.
Still going strong. Now, when you finished your book, you went out and looked for a publisher.
I did.
And you found somebody really good.
The Janet Fix with the word verve is excellent.
That's a nice name for an editor, Fix.
Yes.
Yeah, perfect. So you presented the book to her and she liked it.
Yes. So it was interesting. As others have their tales, I imagine, I submitted my manuscript to a number of different, editors and publishers. And at the end, and I received a number of rejection letters, which frankly I kept, just to keep them. I'm one of those. And so there was something special about Janet and her response, because she wasn't the only publisher who came back and said, I'd love to work with you. There were three. But there was something different and special about Janet's response. And lovely response, a lovely individual. Actually, she said, I'd love to edit your manuscript, ultimately publish your novel. And so we came to an agreement, and that's what we did. She, and for somebody who I didn't know existed on the planet 3 years ago. I mean, I could have passed her in a hallway, not known her, and today she's such an integral part of my authorship. Such an important part of who I am as an author is just amazing. I mean, just the people that the Lord puts in your way and puts in your life at the right time. She's been great.
So she started off with 800 of your precious words.
Yeah,
and
thereabouts.
Then there was a little bit of slicing and dicing here.
Yes, a little bit of cutting the fat, as I like to say. She took a big hunk of meat and said, "Well, there's some nice fillets in here, but there's also quite a bit of fat. Let's start peeling away the fat." Great piece of advice that Janet gave me, and then continues to give me. It's almost like she's Jiminy Cricket on my shoulder, and I hear her as I write. If it's not driving the story forward, just stop. Don't write it. Don't go off on a tangent. That's not going to go anywhere. Just stay focused on the story, and if it's not helping the story move forward, then let's get rid of it. And so that's what we did. There were quite a few tangents that we cut off and we cut off and we cut off, and then at the very end, I mean, there were some things we wanted to keep the story at a certain word count, a certain number of pages. There were some things that I kind of dug my heels in. I don't want to get rid of this part of the story. And she said, "Well, you know what? It's really your choice, but I think it doesn't need to be there." And so some things I kept. have been some things I finally said, you know what? You're the professional. You know what you're doing. And I said, let's cut it. And so we did. And working with her, process of working with her is just terrific. I can't say more about the Word Verve and how they treat their authors and how they treat me personally. Just wonderful.
You start off with about 800 and whittled it down to less than 400.
Yep.
The 400 most precious words.
Thank you.
When you started your next book, were you quite as flowing, or had you learned from that experience of editing
it was...
to edit yourself as you're a little bit as you're going?
No, so it was a learning process editing the first book, and so in developing the second book, there are some tools that I use. So I made some investments in myself. I use a software program called Grammarly, which helps me stay focused. It helps me stay on task. It helps me look at words that Phil, you've used that word 15 times already. Maybe it's time to use some different words. So as one of my very close inner circle folks who's already read the manuscript before I submitted it said, there's a maturity in your writing. You can already tell it's you've matured as a writer and an author in just from the first book to the second book. So because they read the first book in its raw format, and so they've seen the growth. So yes, it's definitely been a learning process. I was able to use what I've learned the first time in editing the second time. Now, we're still at the very beginning of the editing process for my second novel. I think it'll go faster than the first time.
Now, it's always funny when people, the first time they write a book and they do just run with it, and it's... that's the best way to do it. You just have to get it all out there.
Yes.
You can't sort of just hold yourself back, because then you start getting all tight, and it's a wonderful way to do it. But it is a funny thing to look back at, isn't it?
It was. I mean, it is. And again, it was a whole process. I mean, frankly, I had no idea that this manuscript was going to become a book. I sat there and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote the story, and it took me, like I said, 6 weeks. And when I was done, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to have it published. I didn't know if I was going to, seek out an editor or a publisher. This was a new process for me. I had no idea what it takes to get a book published. None. So it just happened that over dinner with some close friends, we were talking about the normal things. How are the kids? How's work? How's life? And in mid, between how's work and how are the kids, I just mentioned, I just finished writing a long story. And my wife, rolled her eyes. She said, he sure did. And right, because again, this was new. This wasn't, this wasn't part of our plans or our roadmap, and so I said, yeah, I just finished writing a story. It took me a while, and then I went right to the kids, and the kids are doing great. My eldest is looking to become a pastry chef, and my middle son's going to the Air Force. My youngest is freshman in college, and my friend Carol, love her. She stopped me, and she called me out. She said, "Well, let's go back to the story thing. Let's table the kids. Go back to the story thing. What's that all about?" And so we talked about it, and she said, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" And I was like, I really don't know. And so one thing led to another. She put me in contact with an author friend of hers, who then actually put me in contact with Janet. And so she was one of the first people I reached out to edit and publish, but not the only, and ultimately one of the first people I went to is the person that I went with. So just again, serendipity or
something clicks. It's a magic moment when things click.
Putting yourself out there, getting to know people, that's something that this is still very new for me. So I've been investing slowly. If somebody would have sat me down in July of 2015 and said, you know, in a month, you're going to start writing your first novel, I would have laughed in their face. I would have said, you're crazy. That's not, you know, that's nowhere in the realm of reality. And the reality is...
The reality is the book is here. It's available wherever books are sold. And the name is Vega, last name Vega, first name Philip with two L's. It's called Last Exit to Montauk. Everybody go out there and get this book. You will love it. It's really beautifully written.
Thank you so much.
Of local storyteller Glenn Erickson comes a tale of romance and suspense. A truck driver encounters a beautiful woman fleeing in the night. Why is she running? Who is she running from? When Richard stops to help her, he has no idea his life is about to change. His quiet life as a widower is turned upside down when he discovers that Marie, as she calls herself, is really an advanced android, one who not only has escaped those who created her, but who has become self-aware. She wants to be free. She wants to live. Can Richard protect her from the corporation that claims her as their property to do what they want with her? Will Marie be able to find justice before she's captured by a bounty hunter? Android love is a new type of love story. Does an android have the right to feel love? To form an unshakable bond with a human that defies logic? The story of Richard and Marie will touch your heart and get you thinking about the world of the future. Are we prepared? Android Love, written by author and storyteller Glenn Erickson, is available on Amazon KDP.
From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try. But first, he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all. Even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope. Written by a true American hero. You'll love this book. Now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
You too.